if we are really going to try and change the course of mental health in this country, it begins at our dinner tables. It begins at those tabletops where we're eating our tacos on Tuesday. It begins with people like you and I having these conversations today.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Ben Miller currently works at the intersection of mental health policy and politics, something even more important than usual in this trying time for our country. He is Chief Strategy Officer at Wellbeing Trust, a national foundation that makes investments in those committed to advancing the mental, social, and spiritual health of the nation. He helps lead strategy and design work for all their investments. Ben was also the lead for the Buttigieg campaign on Mayor Pete's well-regarded mental health policy proposals. I thought we had a great conversation about politics and policy, as well as his advice about how to deal with mental health problems among those you love. So, with that as background, a quick word with our sponsor, then my interview with Ben Miller.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
My name is Ben Miller. I am a clinical psychologist by training, but a musician at heart. I have spent most of my career focused on ways that we could advance the integration of mental health services into all the places that people show up. So I started pretty early on in my life doing that in special education programs and then moved to primary care settings and realized that my true love and calling was in the health policy sphere. So for the last 3 years, I've worked for a national foundation where I've been really leading a lot of our policy work and trying to advance mental health in ways that I think are most appropriate for our communities.
What is it about mental health that you found to be so important?
You know, I think like many folks in those early years where you're exposed to a lot of experiences, you take away those elements that really shape who you are to become. And for me, it was one of those times when I was actually teaching special education in the Southeast. And I was at this school and I just saw these kids in such pain, kids that were suffering. And they weren't just suffering because they had a quote unquote mental illness. They were suffering because they were really under the thumb of a system that kept them down, of families that were dysfunctional because they couldn't get jobs, of just a loss of hope. And so I fell in love with this idea that if we can take control of both our communities and some of those system level issues, as well as do a better job addressing our own health, which includes our mind, our body, then we can have a more productive society and we can all walk into the sunset holding hands, kumbaya-ing. I mean, it would be a wonderful world for us to live in. So my passion really came from beginning really early on, just seeing kids suffer and wanting to do something to help them.
What does help for a kid who's suffering or an adult is suffering? What is the best thing that can improve their situation?
You know, I hate to say it because it seems so like a cop-out almost, but it's such an easy answer, but it's complex. The oldest form of medicine is probably the most powerful one for healing, which is love. And what we know goes into love is a lot of things like empathy and support and respect and listening and things that we all define on our own. But love really is one of those things that almost transcends and allows us to heal in new and unique ways. So when I look at our kids and I look at this generation right now, especially in a time of COVID, where they're having to physically distance and socially disconnect themselves from their support systems, I worry about the psychological impact that that's going to have on an entire generation to not necessarily feel comfortable hugging or to have to keep distant when you see your loved ones because they haven't been quarantined for 2 weeks, whatever it might be. I think that that's going to play a major role in how our kids' brains develop, frankly, and how we see connections between people. So for me, it begins with showing support and being there and embracing each other through love. But it also goes beyond that, because I think as a clinician, one of the things that I've seen over and over again repeatedly is just the importance of support. Just knowing or believing that someone is there for you, even if they're not there, even if you live on your own on the top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere, if you believe that people are there and support you, there's some powerful healing properties in that.
I don't know if this is just measurement of it now, but it feels like anxiety and depression in young people are just at much higher levels than they were when I was young or when my parents were young. Do you think that's right?
It is right. And it is measurable. You're right. There have been studies that have emerged recently that show the increase in some of the issues around anxiety and depression in our youth. But I mean, let's put it into context, right? You and I didn't grow up with the internet coursing through our veins and a cell phone in each hand and, you know, worrying about who's going to click a like here and there on our social feeds. I mean, this generation, I think they're up against a lot of pressures that previous generations have not been up against. Now, that's not to say the previous generations haven't had their own cultural changes. The advent of the car, the emergence of technology, just in general, before we had the internet. I mean, there's a lot of things that really do change generationally. But I think for this generation and our youth, there's never been a time where we are more connected, yet ironically, so disconnected. And it's a loss of some of the things that I think previous generations, my parents, my grandparents really embraced, which is the power of relationships and the power of really just sitting and listening and embracing one another and not just superficially, you know, sending a text and pretending like that's a relationship. So I think that this generation has had some increase in those related issues around anxiety and depression. But I think a lot of it comes back down to just how they can connect with one another and how we can get them away from these almost like superficial barriers of technology that stand in their way of meaningfully connecting to each other.
I mean, you're talking about people need love and empathy and support and respect and all of these things, which are provided in good families and good neighborhoods and good systems. But your area is policy, right? So how with policy do we improve the situation in a way that really has so much to do with relationships and with being around other healthy people who are giving you what you need to be a whole person?
Well, this is part of the reason I love what I do, because most folks do believe that there's a major disconnect in some of the things that you and I are talking about right now on policy. But for me, I see policy, I define it as movement in a direction for a reason. That's the way my mentors taught me to define it. I grew up in a very political, and I won't call them policy experts, but a very political family where we weren't afraid to talk about hard conversations at the dinner table. And so one of the things that I learned very early on is the power of policy to set the context of community. If you're in a community that's got an opportunity that you could get an easier job or better paying job, or a community where it's safer or more secure, or there's sidewalks, or whatever it might be, many times at the end of the day, it comes back down to a decision that somebody made to invest resources in that community. And that's typically goes back to policy. So if you want to have movement in a direction for a reason, are you going in the right direction that's best for people? And so when I say, okay, families aren't thriving, they're not able to be there for one another because mom and dad are terrified they're going to be deported, or mom and dad don't have a job that pays a livable wage, and so they have to work two of them. And so they're not there for the kids. And when they get home for the kids, they're not able to be there for the kids and listen. All of these things, I think, can be grounded in policy. So we spend a lot of time just trying to contextualize the power of policy to really improve lives. And it's not just about federal policy and insurance coverage. And while, yes, we can talk about that stuff till we're blue in the face, what it really comes down to is, are we setting up our communities to be most successful for what they deem to be a priority for them? It might be jobs in one community. It might be housing in another community. It might be something like access to food in another community. Who knows? But to me, those are all policy related issues.
What is Wellbeing Trust, this national foundation you refer to? What is that and what is your role there?
Sure. Wellbeing Trust was started about 4 years ago by the Providence Health System. We were not a conversion foundation. We were started as a gift. So essentially, the leadership in the health system determined that they were not doing a great job with mental health. The nation was not doing a great job with mental health. So why not invest in a foundation that can go out there and change the course of mental health in this country? So that's how we were created. Now, my background is in academia. I spent, you know, almost most of my career at the University of Colorado School of Medicine doing health policy in a more traditional academic way. So to come to the other side of the field where you get to give money away into communities and invest in solutions, it was really a welcome opportunity for me as someone who had been asking for money most of his career. And so Wellbeing Trust is really, our mission is to advance the mental, social, spiritual health of the nation. And we believe that in order to do this, you have to do it in a multitude of ways, including address clinical, looking into our communities, and most importantly, embracing policy. All of that is undergirded by this need to change the narrative around mental health in the country. So we invest in solutions that do all of those things. An example, we put out a federal policy guide for Congress on what they could do to better address mental health and addiction through policy. And we called it Healing Nation, because if you look at some of the data, people are dying prematurely. They're dying to preventable causes. Deaths to drug, alcohol, and suicide continue to rise. And yet, it seems like our Congress is just not paying attention to these issues in a meaningful way. And we believe that it, part of the reason why is that they don't understand the complexity of the issue. They don't understand that just by simply creating another program is not going to radically help communities and allow them to address issues in mental health. So we put it out there and we said, hey, here's a comprehensive way that you can begin to address some of the issues of mental health. So as a foundation, obviously, we have a role to play in convening and leading and connecting people together. But arguably, I think the most substantial lift that we make is we lead through our investments. We put money into places that we think can make a difference and will make a difference.
Where have you put money?
Well, we're much more of a operating foundation. You know, our first 3 years as in our existence, we put quite a bit of money into California. And some of the areas that we found to be the most effective at in terms of putting dollars into changing communities were places that were already really at the cutting edge of reform. There's efforts around integrating mental health services into homeless centers and shelters, making sure that we are addressing adverse childhood experiences and some of the trauma that we know has a long-lasting impact on our kids and our families. But I would say one of the most important places that we've invested is really just to really change the narrative on mental health in this country. So one fun example that I'll give you here is that we partner with iHeartMedia for a couple of years in LA. And so we had DJs on in the morning from Ryan Seacrest to Big Boy talking about mental health, bringing some experts on so that people could call in while they're listening to their favorite DJ and hearing some of their favorite tunes, they could actually also have a conversation around mental health, because we felt like if you could normalize the conversation, that was one half of solving the problem around stigma in this nation. And so let's change the social narrative and get people comfortable saying mental health is everybody. It's all of us. Let's embrace that and let's figure out a way that we can not be so afraid to talk about issues that do impact us all.
I mean, you mentioned the word stigma. Mm-hmm. How is that affecting the ability to treat mental health well?
It's huge. I would say it's probably one of the top two, if not top one, reason why most people don't seek out care. So let's define stigma for just a second. You know, the classic definition is that it's difference plus deviance. The difference would be the in versus the out crowd. So if you are the in crowd, you're the folks that maybe don't have the diagnosis. If you're the out crowd, you're the person that has admitted that you have some type of diagnosis, depression, anxiety, whatever it might be. That is not sufficient for it to be stigma just because you're treated differently because you're in and out. It's how you're treated. And that's where the deviance comes in. So if you're ostracized, ignored, shunned, fired, whatever the words are, you now have officially been stigmatized by whatever your condition. And it doesn't just happen for mental health. That's an easy example. It happens with weight. It happens with all kinds of other health conditions. Mental health for me is, that is probably part of the most important reason why we try to address this. We want to change the social side of that. But we also, through policy, are changing the structural side of that. So just as stigma is difference plus deviance, it's also social and structural simultaneously. So most of these campaigns that you'll see that talk about mental health and, you know, make us feel more comfortable talking about it, that's great. We got to embrace that stuff. But it's social. It's all about you and I talking about this in a much more healthy way. But it's not until we address those underlying policies, those structures that really reinforce stigma. An example would be if you're a kid in a school and you're having a tough day and a teacher all of a sudden becomes afraid that you are now a risk to that school. It's not that you get a mental health counselor that shows up at the school and starts talking to you. You get the police. You get the police officer that comes to the school because that is how we've been taught to respond to kids in crisis these days. So I think that's a structural example of stigma that needs to be totally modified, ratified, whatever your terms are, to make it easier for our kids and, frankly, you and I to talk about these issues.
I mean, it feels to me like it's this difference between how we think about the brain versus how we think about the body. Like if something's wrong with your ankle, it's different than if something's sort of wrong with your brain. The ankle, you go, you get it, you know, it's broken or strained. You go to a doctor without any shame and you say, fix this. If you're sad or if, I don't know, your memory is bad or anything that can go wrong with your brain, it feels more like it's you and you should fix it yourself. And you don't want to let people into something malfunctioning with that thing that's so much you.
The historical underpinnings of how we understand mental health really support this whole mind-body dualism. It makes us feel almost as like as a society, as a culture, that we should treat the mind as separate from the body. But that's just ludicrous because they're not disconnected. They are totally connected. They're interconnected, in fact. And when we consider things like the impact of certain chronic disease on mental health, we can look at the bidirectional relationship between mental health and chronic disease. So it's like they're everywhere you look, you can see these examples of how integrated we are. But because of the culture, and let's go back to policy just for a second, because of the culture treating mental health as different, we've created different financing mechanisms for mental health than we do medical care. We've created different training programs for mental health than we have for medical care. We've trained different delivery systems than we have for mental health, for medical care. And most importantly, we've created this almost like entire system that teaches us from the time we're born that mental health is something that is different. It is distinct. It is separate. Not it embrace it as a part of who we are. And I think that's been one of the most terrifying things. I mean, especially as a father raising two small children and trying to normalize these things, but hearing how people talk about it still, even kids, how they talk about it, in the language that they use, it's almost as if we've forgotten these basic tenets of health, which is that if you don't take care of your mind, you're not going to take care of your body. If you don't take care of your body, you're not going to take care of your mind. And it's as simple as that. It's not simple, as you know, but if we can embrace those almost like bumper sticker and then codify it through good policy that's much more integrated, we will see a change in culture in our society.
This is a political podcast, and it's hard not for me not to think about things like this through the lens of campaigns and elections and candidates and platforms and so on. To what degree are you involved in the politics right now of proposing change, and who are you associated with?
As I mentioned at the beginning, I grew up in a family of politicians, and so it wasn't uncommon for me to have lunch with the mayor on a Sunday and for us to really spend more time talking about who was running for what than who was playing whom on football and TV. And growing up in the South, that's a big deal. And so I almost have been acculturated to talking politics my entire life. And now, interestingly enough, I myself have never gotten involved directly in politics other than volunteering for campaigns. And what I found, especially with the election of President Trump, that it's been almost inherent in everything that I do to fight for those folks who are going to get out there and push for more progressive policy for mental health. Now, that means that you have to find the right person and you have to find the right candidate. And sometimes you'd be surprised. There are candidates that exist on both sides of the aisle that have big visions for what we need to do for mental health. So my involvement, probably most substantial and relevant to this discussion, came about a little over a year ago when Mayor Pete's campaign approached and just said, hey, listen, we want to learn more about mental health. And I was absolutely stunned. This was before Mayor Pete had really this huge national following that he had gained. And so I researched him. I read, you know, parts of his book, and I looked at all the things he had done in terms of policy. And I said, you know, this is a guy who I could get behind. This is a guy who's got a lot of ideas. But I was most impressed because they said, we don't just want a superficial mental health plan. We want something that could be foundational for his candidacy, for his platform. And it's really hard as a mental health guy, especially a guy who loves policy, not to be all in hook, line, and sinker. And so we started having conversations around what that looked like and developed arguably the most robust mental health plan that I have ever seen for any candidate, period. And I mean, that's a big statement. And there's been a lot of candidates that have put forward mental health plans, but nothing like this. I think we had close to 95 citations and 20 some odd pages in our plan. And it was all what Mayor Pete would do as president. And I was extremely proud to help lead and be on that team and witness both kind of the storm that ultimately came from Pete and this community that rose up in favor and support of him, but also to see him on the trail, really making sure that mental health was consistently addressed. And he did that exceptionally well. And I'm very proud of him for continuing to make it one of his top priorities that he talked about.
Was this after Healing Nation had come out?
No, it was before that.
To what degree are those related, or did you build off the Pete plan in Healing Nation, or are they not linked at all?
Well, this is where you got to understand me a bit, because I become a broken record when it comes to some of these solutions. So you'll hear words that I say consistently through both volunteering on a political campaign or doing my day job. And those words are things like this: integrated. We've got to figure out a way to defragment mental health, to integrate it into the broader healthcare system and to our community settings. That's number one. However you do that through policy can be debated. However you come up with creative coverage options for health insurance, that can be debated. But at the end of the day, the non-negotiable for me is that it has to be integrated in some way. The second thing is that we got to bring it to the people. Stop making it so ridiculously hard for us to be able to get access to care, and let's bring services to where people are. So we think about this in terms of disintegrating. I know it's a weird play on words here, but if we've got these mega centers of healthcare throughout our country, why not think about ways to disintegrate some of these centers and bring them back out into the community? The original vision that Senator Ted Kennedy had for community health centers was really that they were about community, in community, for community. Why not really re-envision what community health and mental health could be? To me, that is like foundational. And no matter where I go and no matter what I do, no matter what I write, no matter what I say, it will come back to those two things. So it doesn't matter if I'm volunteering for a presidential campaign or if I'm doing my day job, coming up with bipartisan policy recommendations, mind you, for mental health, they are the foundations for what I stand for.
How is the Trump administration on policy for mental health?
I think it's safe to say that since 1963, since JFK, every administration could have done more. I'll work my way up to where we are today. But if we look at some of the most radical reforms in mental health, they have mainly come through a designation of a commission. President Bush, W. Bush, put forward a new freedom commission during his presidency that really tried to tackle recommendations for mental health. Didn't go anywhere, but it was great to see at least a commission be pulled together. So in 2008, we did see the changes for mental health parity. And this is the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. And that was really to make sure that health insurance was held to the same standard for mental health as it was for medical. And the mental health parity was expanded under President Obama in 2010 through the ACA to really make sure that and strengthen how we could approach mental health and health insurance at the same way that we did for medical. And so we saw some changes there, and that was relatively positive. I think people were pretty proud of that. Under President Obama too, we did see some other legislation that came forward, but I would describe it as more of tinkering. It was putting a little dollars here and there to do some reforms in mental health, but it wasn't anything substantial. So fast forward a few years to where we are today, this administration has done some demonstration projects. They have not necessarily, though, fully embraced what I would describe as a progressive and thoughtful and comprehensive agenda for mental health. And we could spend a lot of time talking about that. Probably the most powerful ways that they have undermined in the ACA works against mental health, from loosening the restrictions on health plans so that we've got a lot more junk offerings out there, to really, you know, almost gutting some of the ways that we as a nation have tried to strengthen our safety net through Medicaid. Medicaid is the largest payer for mental health services in this country. So every time you see an administration do something that works against strengthening Medicaid, it works against strengthening mental health. And that's probably the best answer I could give you right now.
Some people have mentioned to me that just the kind of disruptive style of this president has not been good for mental health. Is there any way to make that connection truly?
Well, there are objective measures. And we've seen, especially in our immigrant community, we've seen rates of anxiety, rates of stress, anxiety, distress, however you want to classify it, and go up. It's not a surprise. I mean, when you're constantly fearful for your family to be deported, or like we've seen with public charge, where you're even afraid to go seek out some type of healthcare service because you might have to prove your status here in the country. To me, that does not work in favor of positive mental health. So I would say that because of some of those changes, because you never know when something's going to happen that's going to most impact you in this administration, I think that works against us feeling comfortable and secure, especially for some communities. So yes, and there are data out there, and forgive me for not knowing those stats off the top of my head, but we have seen in many communities the rise of distress being quite substantial under this president.
I mean, your candidate, Mayor Pete, dropped out ultimately and endorsed Vice President Biden. Were you able to do anything with the Biden campaign, or do you hope to?
I would hope to. I mean, I think any of us that have been involved in developing policy for any of the candidates, and there's a lot of really smart people out there that worked on several of the presidential candidates, I think all of us are trying to pull together to create that comprehensive plan that can really be advanced through a new administration. So, you know, as someone who works with both sides of the aisle, but who's also extremely passionate about issues of policy, I can tell you that there is a fire, a fervor, I'm not sure of the word right now, out there right now to bring forward thoughtful policy that the vice president could bring forward if he were elected as president. And so a lot of friends and colleagues have been talking about this, have been talking both online, offline, and everywhere in between on ways that we can help make the VP most successful.
Does he have a plan currently? What's the status with the Biden campaign on mental health?
Yeah, I think if you look at the vice president's website, some of the things that he's lifted up already around strengthening health insurance, obviously his plan around continuing to lift up the ACA and do some modifications around that. We've seen him really tackle issues around opioids and make sure that treatment for addiction is more readily available. But I don't believe yet that he has put out a plan specifically to mental health and addiction. I would be shocked and totally surprised if that was not something that was forthcoming and that we would see probably in the next few months, especially as we head into the November and our elections and the debates, frankly, because the community, this is something that we've learned, and I'm sure you listeners and even folks you've talked to have lifted this up. All of us can relate right now to what COVID has done to our mental health. It's almost become this strange normalizer for discussing mental health in new ways. And as I mentioned, we had an epidemic around mental health and addiction prior to the pandemic. And so those issues of the epidemic on deaths of despair, things that we discussed, are only going to get worse because of the pandemic. How could you not have a presidential debate anytime coming up and not address what's killing Americans, which are things that are preventable? Things like race and poverty, things like despair. I think and I would hope that the vice president would come into any of those debates quite prepared for questions that could come his way on mental health and what his reforms might be there.
Did you pay attention to the other Democratic candidates and their policy in that area? How are Democrats doing in general? And, you know, if you had your way, would they just pick up the Pete plan? Would you take the best from the various candidates? Would you do something entirely new? What would be your recommendation?
Well, one of the beautiful things about Mayor Pete's plan was that he was planning to invest quite a lot of money in communities for them to lift up their own innovations to address mental health and addiction. And that actually works really well in rural red America. It works really well in blue America. It works really well everywhere because you're supporting local ingenuity. You're allowing for the creativity that is almost like the backbone of America to create new and novel solutions that are best for the people in that community. It is not a top down. It's really a top that supports the bottom coming up and lifting up their solutions. So I believe that if folks want to go look at Pete's plan, I'm sure it's still available online somewhere. That to me, I would totally take and steal and use because it's that good. Now I'm biased, but as a guy who's lived in this space for 20 years and I have not seen thoughtful policy at the level of what Pete brought forward, I would definitely use it. Other candidates did good things. I mean, we saw from Klobuchar to Harris. I mean, there was a lot of really great ideas that were lifted up. Some of them were really just kind of retreading on some of the ideas that have been brought up before, but at least they were brought up. And the thing that I have to say, and I'm sure you saw this, but it was shocking to me the number of candidates on the Democratic side who had mental health plans. I mean, and it wasn't just like a paragraph. It was like a plan. That's radical. I mean, think back to the Obama years or even before. I mean, you didn't see people talk a lot about mental health. It was almost like an afterthought. And now what you saw, at least this last year, is you saw multiple candidates embracing mental health and not only embracing it and talking about it on the stump, but also creating plans, bringing in really smart people, talking to the best in the business and creating something that could, I mean, if they were the ones that were elected, could be something that would be transformational for America.
You're talked about this kind of notion of local ingenuity. And I suspect, without knowing much about it, that like with 50 different states that are supposed to be laboratories for democracy and all these different cities and, you know, even in different HMOs, there must be some things that some people are doing that are really good, that are worth highlighting.
Well, let me give it to you from like simple to more complex. And so a simple example of local ingenuity and creativity is I just moved from Colorado to Tennessee. And so I was in Colorado for 14 years. And there was this part of Colorado, if your listeners are familiar, it's called the San Luis Valley. And it's a beautiful part of the state, more southern Colorado. If you go down to the San Luis Valley, there are a lot of opportunities to see pain, suffering, and then hope. And one of the examples of hope that I saw was a man who owned a Mexican restaurant, really at the corner when you get through the valley, if you're going to, in Alamosa, if you're going to take a right and head like to Durango, he had a Mexican restaurant right there. And he saw too many of his brothers and sisters in that community die by drug overdose. He saw suicides that he could not explain and understand. And so what he did, which is the local ingenuity that I love, is all he did was he created table toppers that he put on the tables of his restaurant that encouraged people that were dining in to talk about issues of mental health, to talk about who do you know that has died? How would you know if there was a problem in your family? What would you do to support? And so, you know, you have Taco Tuesday. What about Talk About It Tuesday? You know, make it a normal thing for us to discuss that in the community. That doesn't take a lot of money. But what it does need is someone to recognize that that is a solution that could be lifted up and done in other places. So that's simple. Now let's go to more complex. If you look at some of our states like Arizona, I mean, the state Medicaid director in Arizona for years recognized that part of the reason really tackling issues of mental health was so difficult is because the administrative structures reinforced fragmentation. So you've got an office of mental health, you've got a director of substance abuse, you've got this, that, and the other. Everybody in our states has got a different structure for how they address mental health. Well, Tom Batlock, who was the Medicaid director in Arizona, realized that that was the most challenging issue that he was going to have to face as a Medicaid director, is having these administrative minutiae and fragmented approaches to taking care of mental health. So what did he do? He created a more integrated administrative structure. And it took him 8 to 9 years to get it right. But talk about complexity. Those of you that have worked in state government understand it's not easy to make changes, especially administrative changes. So I would lift that up as an example. And there's more all throughout the country.
I know that your specialty is policy, sort of big things, but I'm wondering what advice you give to, say, a family, if you have a family member who is struggling, who is suffering with some mental health issues, that could be a variety of different things. What are the moves to be made? What are the resources to be had? What's the advice that you give?
So I start again with the simple, that one of the most powerful interventions that you could ever do is to show support, to be there, to listen, to not always understand, but to be supportive. And that may feel hard in moments of crisis and turmoil, but it matters so much to the individual who's going through the crisis that they know that they've got somebody there who can support them, who will be patient and willing and able to do what it takes. The second thing that I always recommend is that for people to know that there are effective treatments to help, from everything from, you know, first episode psychosis programs. If you heard a voice or you saw something, if we immediately get you in to treatment, the long-term likelihood that you're going to be able to live a productive, high-functioning life is exceptionally high if we are able to give you exposure to an intervention early. And that is not just for schizophrenia, but it goes for a variety of different things, from ADHD to depression to anxiety. The sooner we're able to get someone effective care, the better it is. So the second thing is that there is care out there and it does work. The third thing, which I think is also one that I have to mention because it's one that our families will face, is that we have got to come together and rally behind advocating for something different. Once you get out there and you see that the system is pretty challenging to get into, sometimes challenging to pay for, you're going to want to do something like I want to do, which is to change it. The third thing I would say to folks is, like, it is not sufficient just to be able to get our loved ones into care. But once we get them into care, we've got to fight for better care. We've got to come together and rally around, almost like raising our arms together, or locking our arms together in solidarity for a revolution for mental health. Because it is hard, it is frustrating, and it shouldn't be as hard as we make it. So we've got to figure a way to come together and to support not only one another, but to support change and to promote change. So have hope. There are experts out there that are available to help you, from numbers that you can text and you can get counselors on the phone, to crisis numbers you can call and get people on the phone within 30 seconds, to clinicians in your community, that if we are really going to try and change the course of mental health in this country, it begins at our dinner tables. It begins at those tabletops where we're eating our tacos on Tuesday. It begins with people like you and I having these conversations today.
To what degree, in your mind, does it include medication? In my world, if somebody's, down, you know, I say, well, go, you know, exercise is really good medicine, right? But I've always been a little nervous about antidepressants, say, because I've read different things, like maybe for young people, they could raise the chances of suicide. Without knowing much about it, it seems like might sort of change your life experience to have some chemicals in your brain that you're not used to. How much is that part of the solution?
Well, so I'm a psychologist, and psychologists are not physicians. We do not prescribe, but I can tell you in practice and seeing this over the years that medications are life-changing for many people. Not everybody, but many people. And so when we begin to look at where medications can help, unfortunately, we've gotten to a place in our society and our culture where we want the easiest solution, the fastest solution. We want the kind of Amazon for our health. And that does not always exist for things like mental health. And let me give you a practical example here with ADHD, which is something that I'm sure many folks are familiar with, but we've seen a huge increase in the number of kids diagnosed with ADHD. Well, if you look at the evidence, the frontline, first line recommendation for managing ADHD is actually not a medication, but you wouldn't know that in practice. If you look in practice, one of the first things that happens is you get a script for Ritalin. Here's your stimulant. Go take that and you will focus. The funny thing is that everybody benefits if they had a stimulant. It just makes you more focused. Everyone benefits. And so there's a problem there, because what we do is we actually decrease the likelihood of the most effective intervention working, like a behavior change, if we use a medication first. And it's not just for ADHD. It's for things like sleep. Sleep, I mean, let's just stay here for just a second. If you're having a hard time sleeping, let's just say you have insomnia. Okay, the number one evidence-based recommendation is to make behavior changes to help you sleep, not to go and take a pill. And there is evidence times 100 on how if you do the medicine first, the behavioral intervention, again, the more effective intervention will never work as well. So I think that we've just got to come back to this place as a society where we embrace having to work a little bit harder to get things that are more effective versus just lean into the easy solution, which would be a medication. And I don't know anybody. I've never met one person in my life outside of individuals who might be managing things like long-term addiction or, you know, long-term severe mental illness who say, I want to be on a pill the rest of my life to help me sleep. Nobody says that. But our culture has been one where we lean too much into those easy solutions that do work for some, but may not be the most effective for all.
So I want to take you back to this thing that you mentioned, Healing Nation. So that seems to me like that's a fair amount of the vision, right, for the changes that you'd like to see or that your enterprise would like to see. Can you go into that in more detail? Like, where should we be going and how would that be helpful?
Yeah, I mean, your listeners can go and look at healingthenation.wellbeingtrust.org and you can see what we've done there. And basically, what we've tried to articulate is that there needs to be a comprehensive framework that assures that wherever anybody shows up with a mental health or addiction need, that there's someone there who can identify and help them with that need. So healing begins by embracing things that are deeper than just delivery and financing. Healing begins by looking at what's right now, what's happening with protests in our streets. Let's heal by addressing issues in Black America. Let's address issues of racism and race and poverty. Those are foundational. Those are the systemic issues that we know plague communities and work against their mental health. And while we do that, contextually, let's also look at all the places that people can show up for mental health needs. And I'll give you an example. So schools, okay, somewhere between 30 and 40% of our kids receive mental health services in their schools, but yet they're more likely to have a police officer in their school than they are a counselor. So why would we not want to create radical policy that reinforces this need to have more attention to our kids' mental health and bring mental health services into those schools? And while we're doing that, let's connect it to the pediatric setting, because we know that if kids are going to have a mental health issue, that the school is probably going to be talking to the pediatric practice, except they don't. So how do we integrate into the pediatric setting too, to make sure that our kids are getting access to mental health? And I can go around the horn, but Healing the Nation posits that if we really want to change mental health in this country, we've got to make it where there is, this is cliche, but it's true, no wrong door for people to be able to get access to mental health. Just as much as it's your employer who's got to make sure that you've got good benefits, if that's what they choose to do, they've got to make sure that on-site mental health would allow for them to have a more productive workforce, or your primary care setting, or your school, or your jail. I mean, I can list them all. So for us, that is really at the heart of Healing the Nation, is that let's embrace these issues that have plagued us culturally. Let's create an actual system of care, one that's integrated, and let's fight every day to make sure that we put the person and their family at the center of it.
To me, there's something extremely human about not always doing the things that we ought to do to put us in the best position. It is extremely hard for almost everybody to eat well, to exercise, to find balance, to get help if we need help. I mean, there's something in us, many of us, that resists that or procrastinates that or, you know, just falls for spending more time on some social media that's making us feel bad rather than reading a book. Just all of these decisions that we make, it seems like a lot of mental health goes to how do you just do the right thing for yourself or help other people do the right thing for themselves? How do we do better in that?
Well, there's actually an entire evidence base around what you just described. And so I won't spend too much time on here, but let me just lift up the two most important variables in how we do that. Number one, we don't do what we don't think is important, period. Number two, we don't do what we don't believe we can do. There's, you know, decades of literature to support those two concepts. And so I'll just keep it at a really high level for a second. So when we look at importance, if you don't believe something is important, the likelihood that you spend your time addressing it is very small. But it's not even just that. You might believe something's important and still not do it, like exercise. And the reason you may not feel like you're going to exercise is that you actually don't believe you can do it. I can't walk up the hill. I can't get up at 6 a.m. and go for a walk. I can't do this. I can't do that. And so the balance that we fight in terms of as clinicians is that we spend a lot of time trying to help people be more motivated to make those changes, to understand that it is important and that it does work and that you can do it and you should do it. And so it might be something as simple as having a conversation with your friends or your loved ones around small changes that they can make. And I'll give you a clinical example. So let's just say I was talking to a patient and they said, you know, Dr. Miller, I just can't go for a walk. I just can't. Well, I would say, okay, well, how important is it for you to go for a walk on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being not important at all, 10 being the most important thing ever? Well, they were like, well, it's absolutely important. It's a 9 out of 10. I got to do this. I know I got to do it. Okay, well, you know it's important. You want to do it. So how confident are you can do it? Oh, well, see, that's the problem. And I got too much going on. Well, okay, how confident are you you could walk 3 days next week? Probably a 5. Okay, well, what would make that 5 a 7? Or what would make that 5 a 10? Well, you know, maybe if I just tried once next week on like a Thursday, I could get it done. And that, as a clinician, you stick with that. You say, okay, let's go with that. And you might be thinking, well, that's not going to change the person's health going for one walk a week. But you know what? It's all about building confidence. It's all about letting each other and letting ourselves know that we can make those changes and they're not impossible. So we don't have to feel like we have to go out and run a marathon tomorrow just because we need to get exercise. We start with small wins and we work our way up. There are theories and theories and theories that support this. And what's really sad is that we don't oftentimes pay attention to those things that are most important to us because we oftentimes just fall back on the fact that we don't believe we can do it. So I hope that wasn't too wonky of an answer there, because that truly is, I believe, the solution to that problem that you described.
Basically, make small doable changes and then build on them.
Correct. Exactly.
Ben, is there a question that I haven't asked that you would like to answer?
That's a tough one. There's a lot that I think we could talk about, but let me just, I think you asked one of my most important and favorite questions, which is what can we do for one another? I would say, you know, to build off of that, you know, what can we do to advance policy together? And the answer I would say is to have a vision of what good looks like, to recognize that what we have inherited in our country for healthcare, for mental health, is someone else's legacy. And it is insufficient to meet the community needs by simply using that legacy system to really provide for the next generation. So how do we leave behind our legacy for mental health, for healthcare, something that is much more responsive to the needs of our community? To me, that is the next big charge that we're going to have to face. So I hope when folks are paying attention to what candidates are saying in November, and I hope in even the down ballot elections, that people are paying attention to how candidates address issues related to mental health. And if they're not, please ask the question. Ask the question. Ask them what their vision is for good for mental health. Ask them what they would do when their family member was suffering or needed care. And if they can't give you a good policy response to that, or they can't give you a good human response to that, they're probably not the best candidate for change. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I have seen too many people give lip service to this issue and not do anything. We need to make sure that people are held accountable for issues of mental health, because while they are not held accountable, communities suffer. And I won't let that stand.
So if you were running for office and you were asked a question like the one you're suggesting people ask, what would be your quick answer? Let's say you're running for president.
Okay. If I were running for president, I would lead with my language. I would say for too long, mental health has been treated as an artifact, something that's separate, disconnected, not me, but them. As president, what I would do is I would reinforce this notion that mental health is all of us. I will appoint a mental health czar in the White House who will be making sure that mental health is integrated through all policies so that we don't treat it as a hypothetical one-off, but we treat it as something that is foundational for our nation's health. And by doing so, as your president, I will make sure that mental health is finally fully integrated in the way that it always should have been.
Okay, you got my vote. So, okay, if I have a couple listeners, mm-hmm. there's going to be at least one of them who needs to take a step forward in this area. Mm-hmm. What's that one little step that they should take today?
It's a hard question because I think that
there's so many different possible things that someone could be facing.
Right? Well, there are, but I mean, let me just give you one that we've already surfaced. Go home, bring it up at your dinner table, bring it up with your friends in your front yard while you're physically distancing yourself. Just bring it up and see how it feels. Because if you're not comfortable talking about yourself and how your own emotions play out in something as wild and crazy as this COVID-19 pandemic, then you're not going to be comfortable standing on a stage advocating for major reform. We've got to figure out a way to lead by example. And sometimes one of the best ways to do that is just to talk about it with one another.
Someone taking that advice, mm-hmm. around your dinner table, your niece or your uncle or something says, I'm really struggling with mental health issues and in this way. How do you respond in that moment to that person who is trying to do exactly what you've just suggested?
It's okay to not be okay. It's okay to struggle. It's okay to feel the way you feel. We are here for you. We support you. Things get better and we're here to help. Let us know what you might need. If you want to talk about it, let us know if you might need care. We can help you. Let us know. Because what we've tried and do too many times as families is to brush it under the rug and to say, oh, well, you just had a bad day. Or, oh, well, you know, it's just because, you know, whatever. We attribute it to some external issue. When reality is that we should embrace the fact that it is okay to not be okay. And we should love and support and do everything we can to help that individual no matter what. And so I find that there's amazing healing in simply acknowledging the fact that it is okay for us to admit to one another that we are not okay. So as superficial and simple as that sounds, I will tell you that if the entire country embraced that mentality, we would see healing at a pretty profound level.
And if you said to somebody, it's okay to not be okay, and maybe you also said, maybe there's a person that you can talk to that's a professional in this area. And then I think very commonly that response to that might be not for me, or that just feels like that's too scary, or there's the stigma or whatever. If in looking at this person, you think that they could be well served, how do you help them get there? Or is that not your job?
No, it is definitely your job if they're asking for that help. So I'll give you an example of a colleague of mine. He worked in Northeast Colorado, rural Colorado, and he used to ask the question, how many trucks are in your parking lot? And it was really looking at that in the mental health centers, because of the stigma that we've already discussed, that people weren't going to park their trucks there because another friend would drive by and say, hey, that's John's truck. What's he doing at the mental health center? And literally, I mean, this happens daily. And so if they're not comfortable because they don't want their truck seen in a parking lot, then what you say next is, well, who would you be comfortable talking to? And that person might be their primary care physician. That person might be their parishioner, or the person that leads their church, whoever. And at a certain level, if you're able to get into conversations with somebody somewhere that's got a little bit more training and expertise than you at the dinner table as a family member, then you're making progress.
Ben, is there anything else you want to say?
If there was one additional thing that I would say today is that let's make mental health a priority for all of us. And so going into November, talking with whoever's going to be running for whatever seat, let's ask them those hard questions and let's make sure that we prioritize mental health at the ballot. Because if we don't, I don't think we're going to see substantive change. And it does feel like a moment in 2020 between Black Lives Matters, COVID-19 and everything else in between. It feels like now our nation should be prioritizing mental health. So let's figure out a way to make that a priority through our policy and through our politicians.
Well, I'm glad you're out there fighting that fight, and I hope we make progress in the next 4 years.
Yeah, I do as well. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you.
That was Ben Miller at Wellbeing Trust. He's at wellbeingtrust.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.